So, where are you on holiday?
Well, I'm in Essex.
You're an Essex boy.
Yeah,
Nice.
it's a, I'm on the Essex coast.
Are you?
Well, I'm not at the moment because we're pre-recording this, but that's
Yeah.
where I'm going to be.
What do you imagine it would be like there?
I know what it's like there because I've been to it's a town called Maldon. I've been there before and we're staying in a little sail loft overlooking the harbour. It's going to be lovely.
That does sound lovely. Oh, well, I hope you're having a great time, frankly.
Well, if it's not lovely, you'll hear about it on future podcasts.
Exactly. On with the show.
Welcome, everybody, to episode 299 of the Mid-Faith Crisis podcast. My name's Nick Page. There's Joe Davis.
Hello. One away from the big 300. Getting
Indeed,
excited.
yeah.
Yeah.
Who knew?
Exactly.
Who could have possibly
I know.
known?
Save it. Save it for the 300th.
Yeah, okay. So we're not going to do a great deal of preamble here because, well, we can't be bothered. And also we have a lovely interview for
We
you
do.
To hear.
Yes.
So, Joe, set this up.
Well, I've interviewed the fabulous John Philip Newell. He's just one of these guys. I think his great gift is to articulate what going on that so many of us feel. So he's written a book called The Great Search, Turning to Earth and Soul in the Quest for Healing and Home. And I really enjoyed this book. I get him to explain it, so I'm not going to bother explaining it, but it's available from all good bookshops. I highly recommend it to people. And yeah, this is the interview with John Philip. Well, I am delighted to welcome back to the podcast for the second time the wonderful John Philip Newell. John Philip, welcome back to Mid-Faith Crisis.
Thank you, Joe. Good to be with you.
Last time you were here, you were talking about the other book, Sacred Earth, Sacred Soul. You've got a new book out, which I'm thrilled to talk with you about. But before we get there, just tell us a little bit about yourself. Where am I speaking to you from? No, I know where I'm speaking from. Where are you speaking from? And for those that don't know you, a little bit about us.
Well, I'm speaking from Findhorn. Fairly recently, we've come up to the little eco-village of Findhorn along the Moray coastline in Scotland. And the Findhorn community has been a sort of eco-spiritual community for many decades now, and really in many ways ahead of the game historically in terms of a very strong earth awareness and bringing spirituality to serve that sense of true relationship with earth. So this is where Ali and I are now sort of in transition to. We still haven't quite let go of our main house in Edinburgh, but the plan is to be here before the end of the year.
Wonderful. And some people may know you from the Iona community. Now you write books. Do you do other stuff as well that we might want to know about?
Yeah, I a number of years ago, I began something called the Earth and Soul Initiative, and we offer retreats on a regular basis in different parts of the United States, especially. And then here in Scotland, it's primarily Iona Pilgrimage Week work that we do four times a year. We lead an international pilgrimage week on Iona and access some of the Celtic wisdom of that place and attempt to speak ancient wisdom from the Celtic world right into the heart of this moment in time.
Wonderful. And when you're not speaking and writing and leading retreats, what does it look like for John Philip Newell to relax?
Well, one of the things I've been loving up here in Findhorn is proximity to the sea. So I'm able to walk through a pine wood immediately behind the house here, through some dunes, and then dipping into the sea. And I like to get into the sea every day. That's pretty invigorating. And I also love hiking, and we're not too far from the Cairngorm Mountains here. And that's one of my favorite places on this planet, the Cairngorm Mountains. So that's something we love to do as a family as well.
Lovely. Wonderful. Okay. Well, you've just released, it has come out now, hasn't it?
Yes. Yesterday.
Yes.
was its official release date?
Wonderful. It is called The Great Search, Turning to Earth and Soul in the Questions for Healing and Home. And I'm wondering why now? What have you been seeing that's been going on in the world? Why have you written this book and why now?
For many years now, I've been aware of what is like a great diaspora of our brothers and sisters who began life within the four walls of traditional religion, and many of whom are no longer there. And these many who have left, you know, we're talking hundreds of thousands and probably millions of our brothers and sisters who are quite disenchanted with what's happening within the four walls of traditional religion. And so many of these people continue to see themselves as spiritual, although not very religious in their practices. And I've been attentive to that diaspora, so many people living in religious exile. And I've been asking, what are we searching for? What are the great yearnings of this moment in time? So that's been something that I've been attentive to, trying to engage with for many years now. And then about 3 years ago, I realized that it was important to relinquish my ordination as a Christian minister, because I could no longer make a profound connection between the sense of sacredness of earth and sacredness of every human being that I'm committed to in my life and teachings and writings. And I couldn't hold that together with real integrity with the doctrines and creedal statements of Western Christianity, especially as they were formulated in the fourth century and following. Through the Nicene Creed and so on. So it was important for me to well, I was provided with the right word, I think, not too long ago by a pilgrim on Iona, and she was asking a bit about what my journey to relinquishing ordination was. And she said, "Oh, you gave it back. You gave back your ordination." And in some ways, I prefer to speak in terms of I've given it back. It doesn't fit anymore. It isn't the right thing for me. And it's been important for me to take that step very intentionally in terms of my own integrity as a teacher, but without thereby judging my many brothers and sisters who continue in ordained ministry, because I have great respect for what so many of them are doing within the four walls of our religious inheritance. But one of the things I've become very aware of, I think especially since my decision to relinquish ordination, is that very deep in our Judeo-Christian inheritance and very deep within our scriptures is a creative tension between the prophetic and the priestly, or calling out from the wilderness and trying to serve within the temple. And I think that we need voices for change, both from the wilderness, as it were, and that's where I see myself much more now. But we also need voices for vision and change from within the temple or from within the four walls of religion as well. And part of that for me has to also realize that prophetically in our Judeo-Christian inheritance, the prophet calls out not just to sound off for himself or herself, but the prophet speaks out of love for the family from which he or she has come. And that's really what I'm trying to do. So when I'm calling for change and when I'm speaking much more from the wilderness now, it is also with a hope that there may be real change within the four walls of our religious inheritance.
Thank you. I mean, I'm wondering whether part of the creedal statements that you perhaps don't agree with, I'd be interested to know, is the exclusivism of many often. You have been writing about one earth, one people, you know, the family of humanity and of us being Earth. It's not just about the human project. There's all the creatures, there's the land, there's the sacredness of all things. And I wondered how important it was to you in this new book to be drawing not just from your own religious heritage, but drawing from other traditions as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, for those with eyes to see, there's a deep continuity between Sacred Earth, Sacred Soul, my previous book, in which I was drawing on the wisdom of great Celtic Christian prophets from the second century right through to today. And so for those with eyes to see, there's a very deep continuity between these books. But in this one, I'm very intentionally drawing from different parts of the world, different spiritual traditions, because this time of urgency that we are in, this time of transition in which a new way of seeing is trying to be born and a new way of interrelating and believing is trying to be born within us. It's not just about the future of religion, it's about the future of humanity. And if we don't discover what it is to be in true relationship with Earth and commit ourselves faithfully to one another and to Earth, then the very future of humanity is in doubt. So I think it's pretty important in this book to be getting as sort of wide and vast a perspective as possible. And although these teachers that I draw from, these great prophetic figures, come from different nations, different spiritual traditions, different walks of life, there is in all of them a great love of Earth and a great belief in the sacredness of the human soul. So a big part of what I'm trying to call us to is to return to the true nature of Earth as sacred and the true nature of the human soul as made of God.
Yeah, that's great. Well, look, let's dive into the book. And I'd like to explain to the 17, as we know them, or listeners, as other podcasts call them. I'd like us to just explain the layout. You've written in three parts. There are 9 chapters and a conclusion. Could you just talk us through the chapters? Would that be all right? Because there's only 9. So I don't feel like that's too many. It's not 58.
Yeah. I'm very happy to point briefly to the
essence. That would be wonderful. Thank you.
So I've already spoken a little bit about what are the yearnings of the human soul at this moment in time, and as a sort of preface to talking about the 9 chapters and 9 themes. It might be helpful for me to speak a little bit more about what I mean by yearnings and how it is that getting in touch with the deepest yearnings of our soul is an important part of the way forward, I believe, in healing and finding a deep sense of home address within ourselves and in our relationship with Earth. So it was Simone Weil, the young Jewish woman philosopher who escaped Paris just before the Nazi occupation of her homeland during World War II, but then who tragically died before the end of the war. But she uses a phrase in one of her writings that has been really important to me over these past years. She speaks of the efficacy of desire. And what she's meaning, I believe, by that phrase is that getting in touch with the deepest yearnings or holy desires of the soul, getting in touch with these depths is efficacious. That is, it helps realize, it helps bring up into consciousness and from consciousness into action what it is that we're yearning for. So to begin to try to give articulation to these deep yearnings of soul, I think is a really important part of the way forward. So each chapter is about what are we seeking? What are we searching for? So chapter 1 is seeking vision. And it's about seeking a sense of the sacred way beyond any of the boundaries that our religion or culture has tried to place on sacredness. And it's really seeing the whole universe as sacred. And it's seeing that everything that has come into being in the universe is both a spiritual as well as a physical reality. And the prophet that I draw from in chapter one is Thomas Berry. He was a theologian, but he preferred to call himself a geologian because he was so focused on an awareness of the sacredness of Earth. Chapter two is called Seeking Earth. And this is the chapter in which I particularly explore the importance of coming back into true relationship with Earth, and not only relationship with Earth, but a type of love affair with Earth. And the prophetic figure that I draw from there is a Scottish poet, Nan Shepherd, who very beautifully expresses her relationship with the Cairngorm Mountains as a type of metaphor for what our love affair with Earth is to be. And it's this love affair with Earth that I think we need to keep falling in love with Earth. This is the passion, this is the fire that will sustain true change in terms of how we're living and interrelating. Chapter three is called Seeking Presence, and this is about looking for the divine in every encounter and in every moment of life. And it's about looking for that presence of the eternal within us, within one another, but also knowing that we carry and we can carry that presence for one another, certainly in terms of how we act, in terms of how we speak, but even in terms of how we think, how we look at one another, how we perceive one another. And the prophetic figure that I draw from in that chapter is Martin Buber, the great Jewish teacher who lived through the rise to Nazi power in Germany and then was exiled to chose exile to Jerusalem for the sake of his safety of his family just as the war was breaking out. And his great book, of course, is called I and Thou. He so simply but so profoundly invites us to look for the eternal Thou in one another and in all life forms.
Wonderful.
Chapter four is called Seeking Awareness, and this is about allowing what is deep in the unconscious to be accessed much more intentionally, to pay attention to what's trying to come up in our imagination, to pay attention to what is coming up in our dreams, and realize that new ways of seeing, new ways of awareness are forever trying to rise from deep within the human soul. And the prophet that I draw from there is Carl Jung, the founder of analytical psychology. And his awareness of the importance of being aware of both the light and the shadow within ourselves, and knowing that real change, real healing is enabled by the commitment to awareness of whatever is within us.
I mean, I loved all these chapters, but I have to tell you that one really spoke to me. I just feel like the church for many years in my experience nurtured just shame over the darkness. You know, there was it was just let's just not talk. It's too shameful. And I see an invitation to bring all of who we are to the light that
That's right.
without fear. And it's just so helpful. Thank you. Sorry. Didn't mean to interrupt you. Do carry on.
And Jung just feels that religion often hasn't gone deep enough, in part because we've been frightened of the shadow or frightened of dimensions within us that we that may seem new and strange to us. But yeah, his path is very much about without deeper awareness, we will not move into well-being. And then that chapter flows very naturally into chapter five, which is seeking wholeness. And this is in part about the increasing realization that's coming at us from nearly every great discipline of thought and study. And that is that the wellness of the part and the wellness of the whole belong inseparably together. So that I can't claim to be well if I'm ignoring your well-being, or if I'm ignoring my neighbor's well-being. Our nation can't claim to be well if we are wronging other nations or not committed to the well-being of other nations. The human species can't be well if we're ignoring the well-being of every life form. And the prophet that I draw from in chapter five is Julian of Norwich, and her extremely well-known and celebrated phrase, "All shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well." And one of the sort of exciting things for me in working on that chapter was to remember that Julian speaks these words in the most horrendous and extreme pandemic that humanity ever experienced, the Black Death and plague. So these are not sort of naive,
No.
sort of optimism in the face of not really looking at and experiencing suffering. These are words that come out of a very deep spiritual vision. Chapter six is seeking love, and it's as Rumi, the prophet who I draw from, not just love but love madness. Seeing our capacity for love and the love yearnings that are deep within us as part of what it is to be made of God, and to be guided by love and not predominantly by the fears and the hatreds that so fragment us and separate us from each other. Chapter seven is seeking wisdom. And in part, this is about much more consciously accessing the wisdom that was fashioned in us in our mother's womb. So not a wisdom that is somehow essentially foreign to us, but a wisdom, a divine wisdom that was knitted into us in the womb. And part of how I approach the seeking of wisdom chapter is the importance of seeking Eastern wisdom as well as Western wisdom. These wisdoms are really given to complete each other. And the East has had a much more unitive vision of reality, seeing the essential oneness of all things. And the West has been very strong at celebrating differentiation and uniqueness. So how do these two rich ways of seeing, how do they meet and marry within us? And the prophet that I draw from is the Indian Rabindranath Tagore, and he was very committed to a true meeting of East and West. Chapter eight is seeking meaning, and particularly looking for meaning in both the joy and the glory of life, as well as in the suffering and struggle of life. It's often so much easier to be speaking of meaning when we're in the midst of happiness and when in the midst of the beauty of life. But it's equally important to be discerning deep meaning in life, even in the midst of great struggle and suffering. And the person that I draw from in chapter eight is Etty Hillison, and her diaries that she kept after the Nazi invasion of Holland, where she lived, And her life was ended in Auschwitz, where she was murdered by the Nazis. And the most repeated phrase in her diaries and in her letters over these years is, "I believe that life is meaningful and life is beautiful." And that, again, this is wisdom spoken not from a naive and stupid place, but from the very heart of the horror of what humanity is.
I found that heartbreaking chapter actually to read it, because it wasn't just her, it was the whole family. It was awful. And yet here you don't find hate. It would be so natural to see hate there.
Yes.
But
yes,
instead this robust, real, nothing trite about this. I mean this is extraordinary love.
Yes. I mean I weep again and again when I'm reading Etty's diary and letters, and it's a weeping in part because she leads us into some of the horror of what we are capable of saying to one another. But it's a weeping for me. It's because something so deep in me is being touched by what she calls the importance of digging God out. So whatever the situation, whether it is one of joy or whether it's suffering, she sees this dialogue with the divine at the heart of her being as the very heart of meaning and true beauty. Chapter 9, the final chapter, is Seeking Faith. And in that one, I am really wanting, with Edwin Muir, the poet that I use as the main prophetic figure, to allow ourselves to reimagine what we mean by faith. Because we've so often associated faith with belief in propositional statements, sort of creeds that have been formulating, sort of agreeing to truths that in a sense have been dispensed from above in this type of hierarchy of truth. But for Edwin Muir, seeking faith was about being faithful to what he called the immortal light or the immortal shining that can be glimpsed deep within every human being and every life form. Mm. And also for him, the rediscovery of faith, or finding faith in a new way, was very related to affirming the child's way of seeing. So he comes back into relationship with a way of seeing that was his in childhood, when he was very aware as a child of the light that is shining in all things. And I think this is a really important one. I wanted to place it in the significant position of the last chapter, because I think that this is one of the big challenges at this moment in time, to leave our religious inheritance in terms of saying that is not expressing my soul and the soul of earth is yearning for at this time, is not to be a person without faith. And you know, my decision to relinquish ordination was not at all saying I do not have faith. It was to say I am following my yearning for faith, and the importance of reimagining what exactly we mean by faith.
Well, thank you, and thank you for sharing some of your story as well. I should also say that you've done a series of little meditations at the end of each chapter. So just to really allow this stuff to settle in us, these yearnings that you've articulated, to really, you know, nestle down deep into our being. And they're really good as well. I mean, as I read it, I thought, you know, clearly, you know, each chapter is sort of dealing with a different one of our yearnings, but there was a tremendous unity I saw coming through some of these things. A few themes. One was this tremendous sense that seemed to have been ignored in my own tradition of the oneness of all things, the sacredness of all things. And clearly there were Christians and writers from other backgrounds writing about this a long time ago. It's not a new thing. It's not a 21st century thing. This wisdom's always been around. I guess we'd say it's a timeless wisdom. And it really struck me, the commonality that exists between people, even of different faiths, trusting that somehow, I mean, you used a phrase when you were talking then, I wrote it down, we are made of God. And these writers seem to be saying that. Now that would cause at least a raised eyebrow in some circles I used to be a part of. And I wonder how do you see now who God is, or as I prefer to say, who or what the divine is, and who we are? Now that's not an easy question for a short interview. But I've got John Philip Newell here, and you know I'm going to ask these questions. how do you view the divine and the relationship between us and the divine now?
Yeah, well, I think we get some help on that front from Julian of Norwich, who and she is the one who in fact says we're not just made by God, we are made of God. Which is to say that our essence has come out of the very heart of God's being, and is to say that deep within me is something of the creativity of the divine, deeper than any barrenness in my life or deeper than any barrenness in the world, is this capacity, pure gift of God within me to give birth to what has never been before. Or to say that we're made of God is to say that at the heart of our being is the wisdom of God, deeper than any ignorance that has come to characterize my life or my relationships. And this wisdom, this creativity, these yearnings of God for love are longing to be born again in us. They're longing to come forth again in new ways. But it's Julian of Norwich who says very helpfully and very challengingly, I think, because this is not how many of us were sort of trained to see in our religious traditions and inheritance. But she says that knowing God and knowing the depths of the soul are inextricably bound together. It's like an eternal knotwork. In which you can't see where one strand is distinct from the next. They're so interwoven. So her sense is that there's not a knowing of the divine that's to be separated from a knowing of one's own soul. And we find this in someone like Etty Hillesum as well. She speaks of God, but she says by that she's really meaning that which is deepest within her and deepest within all things. I think one of the commonalities between these nine teachers is that there's all in all of them a very powerful and passionate sense of the immanence of the divine, the withinness of the divine.
Yeah.
As well as a sense of the otherness of the divine, but not in terms of the separation between spirit and matter, or heaven and earth, the divine and the human, that has characterized a lot of the dualism of Western thought and Western Christianity.
Yeah, for sure. And one of the sort of yearnings that I think comes through this book is, you haven't addressed it specifically in those chapters, but the yearning for peace. And I feel like this is a very peaceful book. It's a very inspiring book. You know, you don't spare us the detail. There's a couple of horror stories in there. I'm thinking of the Etty Ellison one and also Rabindranath Tagore's story in India. Yeah. And yet there they are facing, you know, some of the worst atrocities humanity can throw at them. And I'm not saying, oh, they floated through it. Well, then you're definitely not saying that. And yet they had this depth of connection with the divine at their hearts that seems to me to be the peace that I am yearning for. And I want what they got. I really do. So thank you for painting those pictures.
I mean, one of the things I realized a number of years ago, I mean, I'm a bit of a slow learner, I think, in my life, but I'm grateful to have really learned this. And it came out of one of our Iona pilgrimage weeks. And At the end of our pilgrimage weeks on Iona, we often ask people to offer one word that speaks of their gratitude for what's been happening during the week. And there was a gentleman at the pilgrimage week who was Buddhist. His wife was Christian, but they were there together. And his word was transmission. And that's a very important word to a Buddhist, because the role of the teacher is not to see the teacher as an original fount of wisdom, but rather is to see the teacher as transmitting wisdom that has been and speaking it in new ways for this moment in time. And when I heard his word transmission, I thought, ah, yeah, that's it. That's what I love to do. And not to inflate myself to speak about a gift of mine. I'm just grateful that I have this gift, because gifts are given to use for one another. But I think I do have the gift to distill wisdom from great teachers, to try to transmit their wisdom by speaking their wisdom in new ways for today. And that's really what I've tried to do in this book. But one of the great blessings attached to using that transmission style of teaching is that in the couple of years that I was working on this book, I was being fed by some of the greatest souls
that have
lived in the modern world, especially. So my prayer is that if I have been fed, then there's a greater hope that my work is going to feed others and nurture others.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things you won't know is that on our podcast, we've got a kind of sub-series rolling along through it now, which is a faith for the 21st century. What would it look like? What is it? Is there even a role for faith? I suppose is a more basic question. I think there is. That's my supposition. But what kind of faith? And it struck me reading this, as I read through these people and thought, golly, they've got something I want. And this is feeding my soul. This is vitally relevant to this moment in time, a time when we've been seeing riots on the streets, where we're getting concerned about rising water levels and all kinds of other things. There was stuff here that fed that for me. But I wonder what you would say to people who do feel like they're in the diaspora. They do feel like that, well, we've left and we don't know where we are now in terms of faith communities. But we'd love to belong somewhere. We'd love to have a home where we could go and speak about this kind of wisdom together and learn together. What would you say for those people, and what do you see happening, if anything?
Well, a couple of things. One is that I think that there's a desire to encounter the divine and experience the divine, rather than to just hold certain beliefs about the divine. And I think this is a really healthy desire that characterizes many at this moment in time. Not a set of beliefs about the divine, but rather a knowing of the divine experientially, deep within oneself, and deep in our encounter with the life forms of Earth. So that's one thing, that I think that faith should not just be seen as a set of beliefs about the divine. And, part of what I tried to do in the last chapter is to see faith in terms of what it is to be faithful to the true essence of one another, to the of Godness that is at the heart of your life and at the heart of everyone that I encounter, every human being, and to be faithful to that divine spark that can be found deep within every life form. So faith for me is very importantly to be linked to faithfulness, rather than sets of beliefs about the divine. And I think that's part of what we find in the sort of Hebrew word that is used for faith. It's much more to do with faithfulness rather than sets of belief about. And then sort of going back to Simone Weil's point about the efficacy of desire, I think it's as we more intentionally and to deeper and clearer levels get in touch with what the yearnings of our souls are, that will guide what it is we choose to do in relationship and in community. It is that that will help guide our spiritual practices. It's that that will help guide our compassionate action. It's that that will guide what sort of meditative practices we choose to do individually and also together. I have been deeply impressed in my life and blessed also by many of the women's religious orders within Catholicism. Many of these women are sort of radically disobedient. They're quite sort of happy not to be told what to do by the Vatican, and they you know they're often in trouble because they don't sign up to the hierarchy. But one of the things I've seen in so many of the women's religious orders is that they've realized that we have no right to perpetuity. Religious orders don't have any right to perpetuity. The whole religion of Christianity and any other religion doesn't have the right to perpetuity unless we are a blessing to humanity and to Earth.
That's interesting. Yeah.
So I think part of what they have shown me is the importance of letting go of many things that have characterized their religious orders and many things that have characterized their religious inheritance. So, you know, when it took me a while to realize when I was with many women's religious orders that they weren't having Mass on a Sunday. And they simply didn't want to keep using language that was so related to notions of substitutionary atonement in which a transcendent being needed to be paid by blood sacrifice to forgive us. And also they didn't want to be in a situation of having to wheel in a sort of male priest to preside. So, you know, they do things like sort of meditation and so on a Sunday morning. And many of them are not even continuing to try to attract novices to their orders. They're saying, let's redistribute the wealth of the, you know, many of these communities have vast land resources and other resources. And I see them turning over their land to young men and women in Ireland and so on to organically farm their land. Let's not think that our religion is as fixed and perpetual as we've been given the impression of. Let's keep being willing to get things out of the birth canal that are blocking the birth. Let's be willing to let go of anything that is an obstacle to the way of true love and true interrelationship.
And that was the other theme, of course, that unites all these writers, that just the dominance of love in their writings and the primacy of love in all things. Yeah. Yeah. This is the almost the touchstone of the divine. Yeah. I was asked a really interesting question by my spiritual director last time I went there. And I'm still pondering. He said, where is Christ located in you and how? And I'm starting to realize that, you know, one of the ways is as I love.
Yeah.
That there I find Christ in me. Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the things I tried to do in the conclusion is to point to these two primary expressions of love. And I called it the no of love and the yes.
Yes. Yeah.
So, you know, to love, to speak in terms of love and to live in relation to love is not just to affirm the sacredness at the heart of every human being. It's also to say no to the things that are threatening the sacredness of Earth and sacredness of every human being. And this is again, is it, it, this is an aspect of what I think the true prophetic is, that the prophet denounces what is false, what is wrong, what is destructive. And the prophet also announces, which is the yes. I think it's the saying, the saying that, you know, at the heart of every life form, at the heart of every human being is divine presence. So it's the yes and the no.
Well, John Philip, I'm so grateful to you. Thank you for writing the book, The Great Search, available now in all good bookshops. Thank you for the work that you do and continue to do. And we wish you every blessing as you continue to do that work. Bless you. Thank you.
Thank you, and to you.
So that was Joe interviewing John Philip Newell. I was intrigued because so many of the, as he calls them, prophets, the people he's talking about, are people who I've known of or have read, and you know, Julian of Norwich and little Marty Buber.
Little Marty Buber.
We love him on this show.
Me too.
We've always loved him. And Carl Jung. I mean, Jung hugely influenced me some time back. So that was it was good to hear them. And Simone Weil, we've talked about a lot of these
people.
Yes,
exactly.
Actually.
So
that was good. I mean, what really struck you out of the book? You know, what did you really love about it?
I loved being reminded of the central teachings of some of those characters. And the one that really struck me was Jung, actually. It was Carl Jung, and just how for faith to really develop, one has to go a bit inside. You know, you're not going to find it out there. You're going to have to turn in. You're going to have to start understanding yourself. And I think when I started talking about stages of faith, it all sounded very sensible, very sort of logical and everything. But I don't think I'd really realised how much faith development really goes sort of hand in hand with well, psychology, I guess. In my case, therapy. You know, like having someone to really help you understand yourself. And of course, that I think that was one of Jung's great gifts, really. So yeah, I found that one particularly, but I have to say I found all of them helpful. I think it's a really lovely book, and I think what it does, it doesn't give lots of answers the way you want, but what he does is he articulates so well that kind of hunger, yearnings, he calls it, the yearning of our hearts for something, and why we're feeling them, and where that's coming from, and what that is. Now, he doesn't then tell us, unfortunately, what a church for the 21st century should look like. But actually, I think this is really helpful groundwork. That was my feeling.
That struck me a little bit as well. I haven't read the book, so I can't really comment on the rest of it. But I think the idea that you should pay attention to your yearnings. I mean, Jung obviously was very strong on this in terms of dreams and what they were trying to tell you. And your yearnings can be good and bad. You know, we can yearn for the wrong things. But I do think that I think God is actually interested in what we want.
Yeah.
If the father kind of metaphor for God is true, or even a mother, it doesn't matter, the parent metaphor, then a good parent is going to be interested in what are the desires of our hearts, of the hearts of their children. What do you really want?
I think so.
What are you looking for? So some of those headings I thought were great, you know, seeking meaning, I think, is really important. I've been thinking a lot about that. I think people really, you know, that makes such a difference to people's lives to find meaning. Very interesting stuff.
Yeah.
Anyway, we will no doubt reflect more on these topics in future episodes. But for now, I feel perhaps a pint is calling me from some nearby hostelry, but I don't know where.
Well, you continue to have a great holiday.
Thank you.
We shall speak together soon at the 300th episode.
Oh, wow. 300.